This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, offering a master's program in social work that combines rigorous coursework with field experience. The integrated curriculum develops analytical, leadership, and policy skills essential for effective practice. Applications are open for the early deadline of December 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu. Inspire change. Shape the future. WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
The judge is ordering the government to make a number of changes inside Broadview.
Witnesses described staring down the barrel of a gun or getting shot in the head with pepper balls while praying.
Those individuals conducted activities like slashing tires with knives.
Greg Bovino allegedly told the court that this is his effing or blank city. No, Greg, it's not.
This is In the Loop, and I'm Mariah Wolfel in for Sasha Ann Simons. It's our weekly news recap. The big stories we're getting to today, a lot going on in federal courtrooms regarding immigration enforcement. U.S. Congressman Chuy Garcia says he will not run for re-election. Plus, the government shutdown is causing problems for air travel and access to food.
The FAA will start reducing the number of flights, ultimately by 10% across the country.
Many of you know that we are 2,000 controllers short. The shutdown is having an impact on our ability to maintain those numbers.
1.9 million people are getting SNAP benefits in a state of 13 million people.
There's kids out here hungry as well, too, that's depending on that food, and especially on the holidays. Why don't you do it on the holidays?
We'll get to the recap in just a minute, but before we do, we're catching up with one of our panelists, Alden Lowry, WBEZ Data Projects Editor. Alden, your team has a new investigation out on crime and what it looks like in Democratic-led cities versus Republican-led cities. Now, we're going to hear a lot in the recap about immigration enforcement. And in fact, the Trump administration has used alleged high crime in Chicago as one of the key reasons for trying to send the National Guard here and for ramping up immigration enforcement. But you found that's not the case. Can you tease a bit about your team's major findings?
Sure. One of the major things we found was that when we look at the rate of murder, the rate of violent crime in Chicago, that there were many other cities in the country that had higher rates. Chicago actually ranked 62nd in terms of its violent crime rate among the nation's largest cities and 15th for its murder rate in terms of among the major cities in the U.S.
Okay, so what are your thoughts after this analysis on the messaging we continue to hear from the administration about crime in Chicago, despite what your reporting shows?
I think what we are coming away with is that there is rhetoric that the administration has used to sell to justify the cities that it has targeted, particularly Chicago, and that doesn't line up necessarily with the numbers. Another potential way of looking at this is that for the argument that you can make about the level of crime in Chicago, because there is an argument to be made about that and that those numbers being higher than they should be, there are other places in the country that the administration is not targeting where you can make perhaps a stronger argument for the kind of intervention that they have placed upon Chicago.
Great accountability reporting from Alden Lowry, WBEZ Data Projects Editor. In today's recap, he joined our colleague John Seidel, federal courts reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, and Quinn Myers, reporter with Block Club Chicago. And we kicked things off digging into a major change in air travel. O'Hare and Midway are among the airports that will see cuts starting today. Here's Alden again.
The FAA has said that they're asking for essentially a 10% reduction across the board. They may ask for higher numbers for some airports than others. It's not clear exactly where Midway and O'Hare are going to fall into that. But the idea is literally to kind of get out in front of what the shutdown has kind of produced, but also with some issues that were kind of already lingering in terms of staffing. So, you know, the shutdown's been going on since October 1st. Air traffic controllers are mandatory essential workers. Some of them are working as many as 6-day weeks. mandatory overtime, and they haven't been paid since October 1st. So a lot of people are calling off, and that's increasing the staffing shortage issue even more. Folks complaining about not having enough money to make their household expenses, and even taking a second jobs. And so you may have people calling off in order to work where they can get paid. So the FAA has made the decision. Transportation Secretary has stepped forward. The FAA administrator stepped forward. Both have said, hey, instead of waiting for something very bad and catastrophic to happen, let's reduce the workload to the degree that we think we can keep the system moving, but we can also give some level of relief and allow our staffing in order to be able to do what they need to do. There were concerns about the strain perhaps getting in the way of people being at their best in a very critical staffing job where a lot of lives, you know, just let's be blunt about that, are at stake if they're not at their best. And so this is a move to do that. They targeted 40 of the largest airports in the country from Anchorage to Atlanta, including both O'Hare and Midway here in Chicago.
So it sounds like some major safety concerns here. Have we heard anything about the effects that we are seeing on air traffic controllers who are working these jobs despite the shutdown?
From what I understand, nothing very specific, but the word strain has been used.
Yeah.
So I think there has, at least inside, there's been a sense that, you know, perhaps we're stretching people a little thin, and let's do something before, like I said, before something bad happens. In terms of number of flights, I think O'Hare on a typical day, according to one research organization, maybe 1,200 flights. Mm. So we could see as many as 120 at O'Hare, but that number could be higher.
How were airports chosen for this? Do we know?
Generally speaking, from what I understand, largely based on their volume. But some of the decisions in terms of what flights that are going to be made are going to be really dependent upon the airlines themselves. And so United has come out and said, hey, what they're going to try to do to limit the overall impact on their delivery system is to limit their reductions to flights that are not international flights and that are not hub-to-hub flights, because those are the flights that those hubs are usually the places where people are doing connections. So they want to try to limit the impact in those particular places.
Okay. Are they anticipating, you know, impact on Thanksgiving travel plans if this government shutdown continues?
There is some discussion about that going on right now. The sense is that if they can make these changes now, they perhaps put themselves in a situation when demand will be a little higher during the holidays, that they can accommodate that, take some of the pressure off. But yeah, with the holidays coming, Thanksgiving, and then, you know, if this thing stretches on into December, you've got another holiday season coming up after that. So this could be a problem for a good while.
I do think this could be a big change in the gridlock in Washington. It's getting real for a lot of people now. You know, it's already real for all the millions of furloughed government workers, but now it's affecting the general public. And so this could lead to political pressure on both Democrats and Republicans to finally fund the government. Although as of today, we are not yet seeing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm speaking of that. Do any of you have travel plans this Thanksgiving? Are you, you know, checking any flight statuses?
Yeah. I mean, I haven't booked my flights yet. So I'm already in a pretty bad position. But yeah, it's already not, you know, I'm a little tepid, a little nervous about definitely flying, as are a lot of people I talk to already. You know, there already are shortages of air traffic controllers before the government shut down. So,
you know, I'm not planning to go anywhere, but one thing that I did wonder about, like, Quinn, if you're making plans, do you worry about coming back at all? I mean, one thing that I read in the coverage was people who flew somewhere to get this news, and then they're worried about whether or not they're going to be able to get back home.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, my fiance is on a flight right now back from California from a work trip, so I hope she makes it on time.
John, day 38, the longest government shutdown ever. We've already discussed how it's affecting air travel, but let's talk about other impacts we're seeing locally in Illinois, like SNAP benefits. Can you just give us a rundown on how this shutdown is affecting those benefits, also known to many people as food stamps?
Sure, yeah. And this is another example of how this shutdown is getting very real. So this seems to be an evolving situation, and that's created a lot of this uncertainty. But the lay of the land, as I understand it, is first of all, this federal judge in Rhode Island issued another order, I believe it was yesterday, ordering the Trump administration to fund these benefits in full. But of course, the Justice Department immediately said it was going to appeal. So as I understand it, partial benefits for people in Illinois who are supposed to receive them between November 1st and 6th, those benefits are going out Friday, but some of those benefits could be reduced. And then the benefits for people who receive them after the 7th should receive partial payments on their regular schedule. But this affects nearly 2 million people in Illinois, a state that usually receives about $350 million to administer this program.
Mm-hmm. And how are Illinois lawmakers responding to this? What has Governor J.B. Pritzker done or said?
One thing that Governor Pritzker has done has been to sign an executive order that's going to direct $20 million in state funding to try and fund these food banks.
Mm-hmm. And what else is being done to fill the gaps? Anyone can jump in here, but, you know, we're seeing restaurants step up. Can you talk a little bit about how the Chicago area is kind of stepping up to help out in this situation?
Yeah, I mean, dozens of restaurants have posted on social media, hey, come by, show your SNAP card, and we will try to give you a free meal. Manny's in the South Loop, I think, is one of the more high-profile ones. They were ready to give out 300 meals starting Monday. The Stop Along, you know, that's a small pizza chain on the northwest side, they also are giving out free food. So basically, local restaurants who already are under strain too, mm-hmm. you know, they have pretty close margins. They are stepping up in a really big way, you know, very Chicago way at the moment.
And of course, food pantries as well. But is this enough for families who depend on SNAP benefits? We're talking about nearly 2 million residents in Illinois. Alden?
The answer is
no.
No. yeah. I think, you know, some of the folks who've spoken about this have talked about there's like a shelf life here, no pun intended, and you may have people who can kind of figure it out and piece things together for a time, but at some point people are going to hit a wall, and we will be looking at families who are literally without food and no place where they can go to look at it. And even the food pantries have talked about a normal demand that they see growing. We talked about Thanksgiving being a potential pressure point with regard to air traffic. There's also a pressure point with that time of year with regard to how well some of these safety net food suppliers have in terms of what their ability is to meet this new demand.
Right. We'll all be watching the appeal and how that plays out. In a few minutes, we're going to break down the many court hearings and rulings this week on immigration enforcement, how and when agents can use force, what's going on inside the ICE processing facility in suburban Broadview. But first, Quinn, federal immigration agents raided a daycare this week. What happened at Rayito del Sol on the northwest side?
Right. So this is a Spanish language immersion daycare and school across from Lane Tech. Basically, there's video. A lot of people have probably seen it of this daycare worker getting dragged out of this facility by immigration agents who supposedly had been following her, you know, as she was being dropped off for work. And then she kind of ran inside this daycare facility. Mm-hmm. They went inside, searched apparently room to room, questioned other people about their immigration status. And there's this video of her getting dragged out. Miss Diana, she's been there for a couple years. She is originally from Colombia. There's some dispute over what her status here is to, you know, if she's legally allowed to work. Elected officials of the press conference after this said, yes, she is here legally. DHS initially said she does not have status. When that was questioned, the department did say her work authorization was approved by the Biden administration. So there's still we're seeking some clarity on exactly her status here. But this has really led to basically widespread outrage in that community, specifically on the north side, but pretty much from all elected officials across the Chicago area. On Wednesday night, officials held a rally of sorts in North Center condemning this raid and ICE raids in general. And now we are kind of waiting to see what happens to Miss Diana. There is supposedly going to be a court case next week about her status. Officials think that she might be in Broadview in the processing facility there. So this is a really jarring example of, you know, a lot of, but it's just one of the many high-profile ICE raids, Border Patrol raids that we have seen in recent weeks.
Mm-hmm. That video you mentioned, you can see it at suntimes.com, and you can hear the teacher shouting in Spanish, yo tengo papeles, I have papers in Spanish, but obviously stuff to parse out there about what DHS is claiming versus community members. Democratic Congresswoman Delia Ramirez from Illinois had strong words in a press conference after this incident. Here's what she had to say.
This is the force called Department of Homeland Security under Secretary Kristi Noem, an agency of terror. Yes. What happened today is despicable. It's unconscionable. It's unacceptable. And as the only member of Congress in this delegation, in the Committee of Homeland Security, in the Committee of Jurisdiction, I want you to know that I'm going to be working with every one of my colleagues here, filing an investigation immediately of what's happening.
John, you know, as a federal courts reporter who's been covering this immigration enforcement very closely, do you know, is there a way to track where Miss Diana, as the community knows her, may be? Quinn said she might be in Broadview, but it sounds like it's not clear.
You know, that's one thing that was discussed. And as I sit here, I'm not exactly sure what was concluded in the case we're going to talk about in front of Judge Gettleman, dealing with the Broadview Center, where Judge Gettleman did rule on conditions there. But attorneys pointed out that there's an ICE locator, a tracking system online where you're supposed to be able to see where people are. And the attorneys just told Judge Gettleman repeatedly, it's completely inaccurate. You cannot rely on it. So you might be able to go in there, enter her name, get a location. That doesn't necessarily mean that that's where she is.
Yeah.
I think it's just important to remember when they launched Operation Midway Blitz, in the press release, they said, we're going after the worst of the worst, gang members, rapists, murderers. They had mugshots of people who they said were deplorable criminals that needed to be removed from the country. Now we have video and reports of them going after daycare workers, tamale vendors, landscapers, construction workers, people who are working, contributing to society. I think that just bears repeating as we can, as this immigration enforcement operation continues.
Yeah, add high school students to the list, too. I mean, we've seen all sorts of members of the community be aggressively detained in this campaign.
This WBEZ podcast is supported by the Crown Family School of Social Work, Policy, and Practice at the University of Chicago, where research meets real-world impact. The master's program in social work blends classroom learning with extensive field education guided by faculty known for groundbreaking research. Applications are open for the early deadline of December 1st at crownschool.uchicago.edu/socialwork. Inspire change. Shape the future. WBEZ's Nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
A lot happening this week at the Dirksen Federal Courthouse. Let's start with the high-stakes hearing that played out Wednesday in the courtroom of U.S. District Judge Sarah Ellis. Now, this is related to the treatment of protesters and journalists. John, walk us through what this lawsuit alleges.
Yeah, and this, you're right, this really was part of what I think has just been a historic week at the courthouse. You know, this is the lawsuit just alleging indiscriminate use of force against people who push back or even just trying to observe what federal agents are doing, about tear gas and riot control weapons being used without justification. We heard a clip there about a pastor who was shot with pepper balls in the face as he was trying to pray. You know, just general intimidation tactics and just ongoing uses of force here that we've seen over and over again, this tear gas being deployed in neighborhoods. So that's what it's about. It also deals with journalists who have been, I believe we saw a photograph of somebody who'd been hit by a pepper ball while trying to cover this. So that's the issue at play here. And the Justice Department has pushed back and saying that this is not protected First Amendment activity because, according to them, these people are stepping over the line into obstructing and assaulting officers. That's what they say in return.
Yeah. Quinn, tell us a little bit more about what Border Patrol Chief Greg Bovino has to say about the allegations.
He's basically saying this is by the letter. You know, like we are doing all reasonable use of force. We are not breaking any laws. We're following guidelines. Judge Ellis clearly did not believe that and ruled basically against that in this preliminary injunction. One really interesting situation is, he was deposed and then some of that testimony was played in court over the week. And there was this incident where he alleged he was hit with a rock that someone threw in Little Village during a kind of high-stakes situation there when neighbors were protesting against immigration raids. And basically, it came out that he admitted that he's saying, I threw a tear gas canister after I was hit by this rock.
Mm-hmm.
Came out that that is just not true. The judge said, you lied. That's not true.
Yeah.
So that's it. You know, I think that was a pretty big revelation, probably one of the more high profile ones from Bovino, who, again, is basically leading Operation Midway Blitz in Chicago under Border Patrol.
And on this lawsuit, John and Quinn and Alden, the Chicago News Guild, which represents journalists at the Sun-Times, and Block Club Chicago are two of the organizations behind this suit. But we just want to be clear that you and your editors are not involved directly in that lawsuit whatsoever as you're reporting on this.
Correct. Yeah. I've just been spending all my time in the courtroom, but haven't answered any questions or been involved in the actual litigation.
Yeah, good for our listeners to know. Let's listen to some of Bovino's testimony. The first voice you'll hear is Bovino himself, and he's being questioned by an attorney for the protesters and media groups.
All uses of force have been more than exemplary.
I see. So they have been actually, what would be the word?
More than exemplary.
Is the use of force that is shown in the video and in these photographs in terms of the striking of the pepper balls, is that exemplary?
I won't make a decision on a hypothetical situation, a situation that either I'm not involved in nor do I have any direct knowledge of. I don't know.
How about better than exemplary? Is that a better than exemplary use of force?
I'm unable to comment on what that use of force is or anything else. I was not there.
So obviously a much different characterization of the Fed's use of force than we heard from protesters in the courtroom. Alden, what's your reaction to Bovino's testimony?
I think the thing that has struck me through all of this is that the administration and the actors of the administration have essentially kind of stuck to the script the entire way. And no matter what the actions are, what rebuttals people have, they seem to just stick to the script. We're going after the worst of the worst. We have open borders. We're keeping these cities safe. And people are obstructing us. And by obstructing us, they themselves are opening themselves to our reaction. And our reaction, albeit somewhat forceful and aggressive, is justified because we're doing our duty and these people are getting in the way of it. And the duty, the mission is number one. And how they justify it and how they respond when people push back doesn't matter. That seems to be from the top to the bottom, from President Trump all the way down to the Border Patrol agents who are enforcing what he has enacted here. Even when you see clips of the officers themselves and their interactions, they're very self-assured. They're combative, I would say, and using profanity and other kinds of language. And then, of course, the actual actions in some of the videos that we've seen of their arrest. Everybody feels very secure in what they're doing and how they're speaking about it.
Yeah, and you know, is that strategy part of the playbook of President Donald Trump? And what does that allow Border Patrol Chief Greg Bovino to do in this moment?
I think if you're out on the streets, whether you're leading soldiers or you're a soldier yourself, and you feel like you have the 100% backing of literally the most powerful person on the planet and the administration that is surrounding that person, the political infrastructure, so on and so forth, that's got to give you a great deal of confidence that even if you cross a line, even if you misstep, you're going to be okay. And if you have that kind of confidence behind you, maybe you will do some things that may stretch the boundaries, but you won't even realize it or have any kind of second guesses about it because you know what? No matter what happens, I have a blank check from the President of the United States and everybody in line behind him to do what we're doing.
And back to the courtroom, John, in issuing her ruling, Judge Ellis spoke for 90 minutes, right? What were the main takeaways from her speech?
So the judge spent a lot of her time. She started, I think we'll talk about this. She started with Carl Sandburg's poem, Chicago.
Yeah.
Read the entire poem. And then she quickly moved on to the Trump administration's credibility here, which she found that its arguments completely lacked credibility. And she's not the first judge at the Dirksen Courthouse to say that. And one reason she said they lack credibility, she pointed to Greg Bovino and what she called this lie about being hit in the head with a rock before throwing tear gas. Mm-hmm. She also pointed to the testimony of another agent who took the stand on Wednesday, and we watched video of him dealing and pushing back and everything with protesters. And you hear him on the video, it sounds like saying, hit him, hit him. And this agent insisted when asked, when pressed on that, no, I was saying, get him, get him. The judge said, no, clearly he is saying, hit him. And then she walked through a lot of the additional testimony that we heard Wednesday and that we heard referenced already about the pastor hit with the pepper balls. A woman who was video recording the arrest of day laborers and wound up had a weapon pointed at her. And she described on the stand, like, looking down the barrel of this gun and how that's really affected her. We heard from another woman who videotaped some arrests or detentions and made a comment in front of the agents about them being stormtroopers and how they should smile nice for The Hague. And when she left that scene, agents actually followed her. And again, she wound up having a weapon pointed at her. And the interesting thing about what Judge Ellis stressed was, you know, even though these people have continued to protest, continued to observe, and a Justice Department lawyer even tried to give them credit for that, Judge Ellis's point is that it doesn't really matter that they're still being courageous and going out and doing it. What matters is that it has affected them. The people who testified described thinking twice before doing that. Again, Alderman Julia Ramirez, she testified, and she talked about how she hasn't been participating in downtown protests because she feels like that's too much of a risk. And she told everybody in the courtroom she's 9 months pregnant. She just felt that was too risky to go down and do that. So that chilling effect is what Judge Ellis really stressed. And you're right. It took about 90 minutes for her to go through the ruling and also to discuss legally why she believes that this should hold up on appeal before finally laying out the parameters of her order.
Okay, yeah, and I want to hear about those parameters, but first we've got to talk about Carl Sandburg. you know, what was her purpose of reading this poem? What was the message? And have you ever heard a judge perform poetry before in all of your years covering federal courts?
You know, judges and lawyers, they do like to quote people. Mm-hmm. So while nothing directly comes to mind, I'm sure I've probably heard something like that before. I was surprised that she read the entire poem. And, you know, if you go to that poem,
it's a long poem.
It's a long poem. And it talks about kind of challenging people who would sneer at the city. I believe it talks about, you know, they say you're wicked, or there's a line to that effect. And just kind of it boasts about how proud and strong Chicago is and vibrant. And Judge Ellis talked about that vibrancy. I think what she's getting at is this disconnect that we're seeing in this case about what is going on in Chicago, the portrait being painted by President Trump and the Justice Department about the lawlessness and the danger that federal agents face, and what's really happening and what's being documented in the courtroom. And again, that video that I talked about before, that with that hit him or get him quote,
right,
there was also an image of people holding what were called shields that the agent said they were plywood, and they had nails sticking through them so that they could be used as weapons. But when pressed, it turned out that the agents apparently threw those away. So we just have the body cam footage to go on to know what the heck it was. And Judge Ellis, I believe she said in her ruling, like, it looks like cardboard. You know, so, I mean, it again, just getting to these two images of Chicago, and I think the Carl Sandburg poem probably served that well.
Yeah, I mean, Alden, you're a lifelong Chicagoan. What was she trying to convey with this poem, do you think?
I think what I took away from it was this notion that, you know, you can say what you want to say about us. You can come in and do what you're doing here, but, like, this is Chicago. Like, this place is tough. It's resilient. It won't back down. And, you know, nobody can talk bad about Chicago but Chicagoans, right? So in a way, I felt like it was a gauntlet being thrown down and saying, you know, you guys picked the wrong city. if this is what your outlook is, you picked the wrong place. And in some respects, the judge herself has kind of been an embodiment of that kind of spirit. I mean, I don't know if we've seen any particular member of the court across the country that has kind of stood up. I mean, she, you know, pretty much told Bovino, no, I want you in my courtroom on a daily basis. She's hammered away. She's challenged in a way that I don't think we've seen anyone do, any particular single member of the court do. So I think the reading of the poem, what the poem says about Chicago and her own actions are all kind of in line with the message I think she's trying to deliver.
Yeah, here's a line of the poem that kind of speaks to the point you're making. Come and show me another city with lifted heads singing so proud to be alive and coarse and strong and cunning, flinging magnetic curses amid the toil of piling job on job. Here is a tall, bold slugger set vivid against the little soft cities.
Poetry back on public radio.
Bring it back. That was my whole goal for this show. John, can you talk us through the particularities of her order and what happens next? Are we expecting an appeal?
Sure. So yes to an appeal. But as far as the order goes, it largely mirrors a temporary restraining order that she issued last month with some updates. So it basically forbids agents from using these riot control weapons, and there's several examples, but tear gas is a prominent one. They're forbidden from using those kinds of weapons against people who pose no immediate threat. And it also requires two warnings before something like tear gas is deployed. And I think she stressed in this order, these need to be warnings people can hear, you know. She also added a restriction on chokeholds. That wasn't in her temporary restraining order. Those are now prohibited unless, again, and there's some subjectivity here, but, you know, unless they're objectively reasonable in the moment. And, you know, there's been a lot of talk about identifiers. A lot of agents seem to be out there with nothing on their uniform to indicate in any way who they are. So she's requiring SAR numbers or badge numbers basically in two conspicuous places on the agents. That's another part of the order. So I think those are the highlights, body cam as well. And I think she's also stressing that Greg Bovino, she said it before, she's saying it again, he's got to have a body cam.
Who said he didn't know how to use one before.
When he came into her courtroom, yes, even though 99% of the agents here had body cams, he said he was not one of them. He didn't have one. He hadn't been trained on how to use one. She gave him till Halloween to get one. And yesterday she double checked and she's stressing, I want to confirm he has it.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to add, you know, and there's going to be, I know that the plaintiff's attorneys are looking for other alleged violations and there are going to be status hearings and et cetera. But the Justice Department, which I believe said this is an extreme act by an activist judge, has vowed to appeal. And so we're waiting. I think they're waiting for Judge Ellis to issue her full formal written ruling on the docket, which hasn't arrived yet. Once that happens, I suspect we'll see notice of appeal.
I'm curious to see how this impacts the behavior of these agents. You know, Christopher Houston, who you mentioned, who allegedly said, hit him. He said on the stand on Wednesday when the TRO was put into effect, you know, last month, it didn't change any of their behavior because they were already following all of the rules that the TRO included. And he's saying, this is how we've been doing it all along. You know, the plaintiffs allege that that is absolutely not true. So I'm really curious to see what, if any, impact this does have. And again, this is governing use of force. We're talking about use of force. We're not talking about stopping immigration raids. And I think the judge throughout this case was very explicit saying, you know, this is not about your ability to go and, you know, detain people who are here illegally. This is about the use of force surrounding some of those incidents with First Amendment rights, protesters, journalists, that sort of thing.
Alden, your team has a big story out today. As the administration has its eyes focused on Chicago and other Democratic-led cities and states, your team turned its lens to red states, taking a look at how crime and homicide rates compare to Chicago and Illinois. What did you all find and what are the main takeaways?
What we found is some very interesting things with regard to where crime occurs. Gregory Bovino, when he was here in Chicago early on, made mention of Chicago having a lot of murders. We're going to make this city a safer place. And so that was one of the pegs that we wanted to look at with regard to data. So where does Chicago fit? And what we found was Chicago was 15th in the country in terms of its murder rate. That's among the 145 largest police agencies who are reporting that data to the FBI, all serving populations of 250,000 or more. So a number of cities ahead of Chicago are cities in red states, although pretty much when you talk about cities in America, you're two-thirds of the time you're talking about cities that are led by Democratic mayors. And that is the case for all but one of the 14 cities that are ahead of Chicago in terms of their murder rate. But seven of them are in red states, and their rates are much higher than Chicago. We're talking about St. Louis. We're talking about Memphis. We're talking about Kansas City. All cities, with the exception of Memphis, there's been no discussion from the administration around the need to send in the National Guard for with regards to safety. Washington, D.C. was one city ahead of Chicago where that has been the case. Los Angeles, which got the National Guard. Portland, which there's discussions of National Guard just outside of the city of Portland waiting to be deployed, are cities that are much farther down the list in terms of their murder rates. So the question is, if this is a reason why Chicago is getting the attention that it's getting, there are many more cities who perhaps need that kind of intervention, if that is truly the motivation for the kind of intervention that Chicago is getting.
Yeah.
In addition to that, what we found is that red states also, red states and blue states essentially, and by that we mean states led by the party, the governor's party. That's our description of those states. So when you look at the percentage of residents that are undocumented immigrants, those numbers are relatively the same, just about 4%, a little over 4%. But when you look at the growth of undocumented immigrants from 2019 to 2023, this is based on research from the Pew Research Center, the growth has happened faster in red states, 41% growth there, 30% in blue states. Going back to crime, if you look at the overall crime rate, taking those police agencies and combining their numbers and the populations that they serve, the murder rate in red states is 32% higher. It's like just over 5, and it's just under 4. In blue states. So again, this notion of undocumented immigrants, this notion of crime and lawlessness, the numbers don't really line up with the rhetoric, both about Chicago, but also about blue states in general and some of these other cities where the administration has paid its attention. With regard to the criminality of undocumented immigrants, looking at the numbers that we have at our disposal, the Data Deportation Project has essentially sued to get some information out of ICE, but their data is only through the end of July. But dating back to the start of September through that period, 132,000 people have been arrested by ICE who, according to ICE, have prior criminal convictions on their record.
Got it.
Two-thirds of those individuals were apprehended in red states. So if we're looking for criminal illegal aliens, we're probably more likely to find them in places other than Chicago, other than Illinois, and other than some of the other places where a lot of this attention has been paid. But that's what the administration has essentially said to us.
And if I'm not mistaken, you know, is the one city that you're talking about that has a higher crime rate than Chicago that's led by a Republican mayor, is that Memphis?
That is Memphis. And I think the mayor there, elected in 2023, it was a nonpartisan race. We point out that, and he's come under fire for this, because it is a blue city technically, but he's voted in Republican primaries in the past. So.
Okay. Did anything surprise you about this analysis?
The thing that, seeing that combined murder rate in red states is higher than it was in terms of the combined rate in blue states among those police agencies was a little surprising. The thing that really struck me, though, was the level of criminal undocumented immigrants in those ICE arrests. And there's, as I looked into it more, there I think is a reason for that discrepancy. Illinois doesn't participate actively in terms of, and a number of other states do as well. Illinois has a law on the books saying that they do not participate in the 287G program, which is one of the federal efforts to find undocumented immigrants with criminal backgrounds. There's another program called the Criminal Alien Program. And Illinois, of the 50 states, has actually the lowest percentage of ICE arrestees who are apprehended through that program. So I think that helps explain some of that. But still, the fact that there was such a large number and the growth of undocumented immigrants, particularly in states like Florida and Texas, was also notable. Literally, we went from 10.2 million, according to the Pew Research Center, from 10.2 million undocumented immigrants in 2019 to 14 million in 2023. And one-third of that increase, nearly one-third of the increase, is just between Florida and Texas, close to 1.2 million undocumented immigrant growth there. But ironically, those were the states that were busing and flying undocumented immigrants, particularly migrants, I should say, Venezuelan migrants, to Chicago, to D.C., to New York, to other places.
We got to jump back to courts for a second, John. Let's talk about the Broadview ICE facility. A federal judge has issued a temporary restraining order over conditions there. Remind us, what are the conditions that we've been reporting on, and what have we heard from former detainees who testified in court this week?
Yeah, this is one of the reasons why I think this was historic at the courthouse, because a day before the hearing we already talked about, there was a hearing before Judge Gettleman in which he heard from these detainees talking about what was going on inside the facility. And this is really, I think, like the best window we've had into what's going on there. And they described being held in cells with 100 to 150 people at a time, where there's really no room to sit, to move around. Like, you know, there's nowhere to sleep. There are, I guess, some seats or some benches where they've been able to maybe try and sleep sitting up. But otherwise, they're sleeping on the floor. And there's, you know, the toilet facilities are not private at all. And there's so many people in these rooms, according to this testimony, that people are sleeping right beside the toilet. There are people who are talking about getting up in the middle of the night, stepping over bodies and to try and go use the bathroom and try to wake somebody up. Can you please move out of the way? I got to go. So these are conditions that Judge Gettleman really said he found disgusting, and including unconstitutional. You know, one former detainee said she even at one point they asked for a broom. Can we clean this cell? And officials there wouldn't let them do that.
Wow. So. Yeah. Because a reminder, this is typically a processing center. So, you know, an office building not meant for long-term detention.
It was meant to hold people for, I think, hours at a time. Right. And Homeland Security has continued to stress the phrase processing center for this facility. But after hearing what he heard, Judge Gettleman said this really has become a prison.
And what are the terms of the order?
Right. So Judge Gettleman issued a temporary restraining order. Some of the things it requires is that everybody gets a clean mat to sleep on and clean bedding, that everybody should have soap, towels, toilet paper, and just general hygiene products. He required each cell to be cleaned at least twice a day. And I did want to circle back to something we talked about earlier about tracking detainees.
Right.
That was part of his order. It says that all detainees shall be listed on the locator online detainee locator system of ICE that accurately identifies the location of each detainee. So this order does address this issue attorneys have had trying to track where people are being held and located. Mm-hmm.
And I think, am I right, that we're still waiting for a timeline on the government to get back on when they can implement or how plausible implementing these reforms are?
I believe so, and I think we might hear more on that later today.
Okay. Switching gears, Democratic Congressman Jesus Chuy Garcia of the 4th District, which includes the southwest side of Chicago and many suburbs, he surprised folks this week by saying he will not run for re-election. Alden, why not?
Well, the congressman says that he, under orders from his physician, that he should take a step back. As a cardiologist, I believe. He's 69 years old. So there was that. He also mentioned that his wife is dealing with MS and that he wants to be much more present to help her in those battles. And these are all things that came to light for him. It's something he says he struggled with. But he made the call this week to pull from the race.
And Quinn, who is up to replace him?
His chief of staff, Patty Garcia, who previously, I believe, was his district director since 2019. Definitely someone who's been involved in his district. But there are some, people are raising some red flags about the timeline of this decision, likening it to machine politics, you know, basically anointing your successor, not giving, the whole field time to, you know, get petitions and get on the ballot. Which is interesting because Chuy Garcia historically has been an anti-machine candidate. He came up, you know, under Harold Washington, has always been a progressive, one of the more liberal members of Congress. So I think people maybe expect this out of kind of the old school Chicago politicians. I think it was a little jarring, even if, you know, it depends on how much you buy into his rationale about the health reasons. But I think even some of his supporters found it to be a little jarring.
I believe the word coronation was used. Alden, fair criticism?
Well, I will say to Chewy's credit, he didn't do this the way it has been done in the past, where someone will step down midterm, and then there's someone appointed that is, you know, we've seen this with Alderman Alderman Burnett being the most recent, but still, it's pretty much the same impact. In his defense, he said no one else had stepped forward. There was, you know, someone could have submitted petitions and so on and so forth. But the fact that literally on the deadline day, we see his chief of staff submit petitions and get on the ballot is one thing. A thing we should keep in mind, too, Barack Obama, as lauded as he is in Chicago political lore, got his start by kicking off the incumbent for his state Senate seat by challenging her petitions. Another old school machine style political ploy.
That's what they call tradition around the holiday season. Quinn, let's switch gears. State lawmakers passed a major transit reform bill to provide another $1.5 billion in tax revenue, but affects more than just riders, right? What are the highlights? What's included in this bill?
Yeah, this is a really big deal. It's been all doom and gloom for transit since the COVID pandemic. Finally, we're getting this influx of $1.5 billion to come in the second half of 2026. And basically, a lot of drivers are going to feel the pain here, or some pain. You know, they're spiking tollway fees in Northern Illinois up 45 cents for passenger cars. I think it's even higher for commercial vehicles. Also going to see an increase in sales tax in the Chicago area. And then they're kind of redirecting sales tax revenue up to $860 million or so from motor fuel purchases, now going to transit operations. So, you know, for the hardcore transit folks, you know, people who are really advocating for a richer public transit system, they are celebrating this as a huge win for transit. You know, there were some even more, I don't want to say radical proposals, but even more, you know, they were going into it. So, but they're happy with this decision, I think.
Yeah. And the CTA, the Sun-Times reported, you know, this week that the CTA will use its share to provide 24-hour service on the Orange Line to Midway Airport and deliver more frequent and cleaner bus and rail service, which seems like
right.
Good
and
news.
I think we're going to see more frequent bus network. They're going to really rapidly expand that, hopefully on major thoroughfares, having your bus come at least every 10 minutes or less. So yeah, good news for transit. Although, you know, if you're driving and if you use tollways a lot, you might be feeling that in your pocket a little bit.
Okay, let's talk about some good news, maybe, potentially, depending on whether you guys like winter. It's been a heavy recap, so now we're going to talk about the weather. Meteorologists are predicting the first snow of this winter could happen this weekend in the Chicago area. Is November 9th, which would be Sunday, an appropriate date for the first snow of the season?
No, and I'm conflicted with this whole thing around good news. I don't know if anything about winter coming early or winter being severe is considered good news. I don't know anybody who likes winter that much. But anyway, no, November 9th. I will say this.
Change of season, it feels nostalgic.
I have seen some very like postcard picturesque type scenes with the icicles on hanging from the trees.
Yeah.
And I can appreciate that from the inside, sipping hot chocolate and chilling out.
Right.
But not if I have to walk to my car or brush off the snow or deal with the commute in that kind of weather.
I think snow after Thanksgiving. Let's get past Thanksgiving and have, you know, still
that's
have
fair.
The kind of fall leafy crunch thing going on. And then snow can come in December.
I'm not a snow hater, but I do always feel like fall goes by a little too fast. So fall's really nice.
It's the best season. And so, yeah, it is always kind of heartbreaking. Supposedly this coming winter is supposed to bring above average snow and precipitation, according to projections from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Congratulate me on saying that acronym.
Very good. Congratulations.
reactions to that? I mean, it looks like we're expecting a snowy winter.
Yes. I think that's a silver lining, because if it's my thought has always been, if we get a lot of snow, we don't get a lot of polar vortex type cold.
Okay,
and
sure.
I'd much rather, you know, trump through the snow than deal with the cold.
It's been years since we've had a massive snowfall, at least one big event, it feels like. So I could use one or two each winter. It's always pretty fun.
Yeah.
Bring it on, he says.
Bring it on.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. My thanks to our panel, Alden Lowry, WBEZ Data Projects Editor, John Seidel, Federal Courts Reporter for the Chicago Sun-Times, and Quinn Myers, Block Club Chicago Reporter covering Wicker Park, Westtown, and Bucktown, and City Hall. Thanks, everybody, for breaking down this week's top stories with me. Have a great weekend.
This episode of the In the Loop podcast was produced by me, Maha Ahmed, and edited by Ethan Schwab. For more in-depth coverage of news and culture in Chicago, be sure to subscribe to this podcast. For a full archive of the show, head over to wbez.org/intheloop. Thanks for listening.
Rise and shy. WBEZ is serving local stories for breakfast every weekday morning from 5 to 11. Tune in on the WBEZ app to hear what Chicago's talking about as you start your day.